effective than a real infection. One of the researchers, Professor Graham Cook, says, "The big picture is after the first wave, the great majority of the country didn't have evidence of protective immunity," adding, "The need for a vaccine is still very large. The data doesn't change that. What do I need to know about the coronavirus?" Commenting on the findings, Professor Jonathan Ball from the University of Nottingham says, "This study confirms suspicions that antibody responses, especially in vulnerable elderly populations, decreases over time." However, he said it was still important to get a better overall view of what protective immunity looks like. Professor Eleanor Riley from the University of Edinburgh said, "It would be premature to assume immunity did not last, but the data do lend weight to the concern that antibodies induced by natural infection may be short-lived, as is the case for other seasonal coronaviruses." Meanwhile, a new study found more than 80% of 200 patients hospitalized in Spain with COVID-19 had low levels of vitamin D. The study, which was published in the journal Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, found that the majority of patients being treated for COVID-19 at a hospital in the northern Spanish city of Santander suffered from a deficiency of vitamin D. Researchers at the University of Cantabria determined that just 82% of the 216 patients had inadequate levels, compared to around 47% of people in a control group who didn't have the virus. The vitamin, which promotes healthy bones and supports immune system function, is produced by the human body naturally when it's exposed to sunlight, though it can also be obtained from eating foods such as fatty fish, egg yolk, mushrooms, and cheese. Patients with deficiencies of sunlight vitamin D in the study were also more likely to have hypertension and heart disease, as well as experience longer hospital stays. Researchers, however, didn't find any link between vitamin D deficiency and severity of the illness, with no significantly higher rates of ICU admission, ventilator use, or death among those with inadequate levels of the sunshine vitamin.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action, because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in their government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd for 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored, because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is of course very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year, and several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US were more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
It absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who was sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
As with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failures are part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet is something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the US will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say U.S. domination of the world's people and resources, there may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon. A new study has shown that so far in 2020, Americans have purchased at least 17 million firearms. According to Small Arms Analytics, this is more than any other single year since records began. Gun sales across the country had already seen a surge in the spring because of the coronavirus pandemic. But they spiked even higher in the summer of widespread protests and anger over systematic racism. The demonstrations began following the police killing of an African-American, George Floyd. Small Arms Analytics says by August, the US had exceeded last year's total. By September, the US exceeded the highest total ever. It added that the number of guns sold through the end of September 2020 is not only more than last year, it's more than any full year in the last 20 years we have records for. The revelation clearly highlights the levels of unrest the United States has witnessed this year.
There's been a tremendous amount of unrest here in the United States. There has been the Black Lives Matter movement. There's killings almost every day of black people by police and by white supremacists. So there's a real sense of panic among certain parts of the population.
According to the analytics company, the previous record for estimated firearms sold in a single year was 16.6 million. That was in 2016, when Hillary Clinton ran for president against Donald Trump and endorsed a strong gun control platform. Groups that advocate for an end to gun violence say that the surge in firearm sales will only increase the level of domestic violence. According to researchers at the University of California, gun purchases from March to May, linked to the coronavirus pandemic, were also associated with a nearly 8% rise in firearm violence across the United States. That's an estimated 776 additional shooting injuries. With much more ammunition on the streets, there's more fear across the towns and cities of America. A recent report by the Department of Homeland Security says groups and individuals with white supremacist ideologies pose the deadliest terror threat to the United States. Many of these right-wing extremists are armed and have also expressed support for President Trump. The fear is that deadly chaos could ensue if the country's presidential election on Tuesday is disputed by the incumbent. The eldest son of the late civil rights leader Martin Luther King says he fears that the election will bring about another civil war. Martin Luther King III said this is down to the kind of leadership the president has provided.
Without saying it, you know, the president doesn't say that, but he says what he needs to give people comfort in feeling that it's all right for them to say that this is what's going to happen. They themselves have said we might engage in some, we're getting prepared for the Civil War. But everybody is buying ammunition, and it's not one side, by the way. You've got Democrats and Republicans who are gunning up.
Gun owners say months of sustained demand for firearms this year has resulted in a shortage of guns and ammunition. Long queues have been seen at gun stores. The highest sales are adding millions of weapons to a nation that already has more guns than people. With increased political polarization, racial tensions, and anger at coronavirus deaths, as well as lockdown restrictions, those post-election fears are not going to disappear. As one of the world's most talented and prolific strikers playing for Manchester United, Marcus Rashford is no stranger to hardship in spite of his recent success. Having grown up in a single-parent family in one of the poorest parts of Manchester, Rashford himself knows what it's like to go hungry, hence why his passionate plea to feed Britain's children recently earned him an MBE.
People have opinions, whether or not they understand fully what the families are going through. It's another conversation, but because of that, it's easy for me to sort of dismiss a lot of the people that are making their opinions, because, you know, I know for sure that a lot of them speaking the way that they're speaking is so insensitive about the issue, and they've definitely not been through it themselves. So for me, it's, you know, I'll take that all day long as we start to see improvements going forward for the people that are in need of it.
However, in spite of his ongoing campaign and recent effort to convince the UK government to continue to feed the UK's poorest children during the half-term school holidays, it seems that Marcus Rashford has been left in despair as Tory MPs have voted against his idea. The government rejection has been confirmed and approved by Boris Johnson, who has ratified the vote, stating that he refuses to move on free meals for children during the half-term period, in spite of growing pressure from the public for the PM to meet Rashford face-to-face. Although the UK really doesn't care to admit it, the introduction of the so-called tier system lockdown is essentially a national lockdown in disguise, and it's during this challenging time, with parents out of work and schools closed, that there's currently one-fifth of the UK children going hungry right now. Yet when one looks deeper at the figures in the UK, the situation appears to be really dire, with 15 million people in Britain living in poverty, which equates to around 22% of the population. Of these, 5 million of them are children, showing that the UK, as a supposedly developed nation, has deep secrets that it should not be proud of. Add to this the situation that for many school children in the UK, due to the extreme poverty, abusive parents, lack of social care, and a failing government, for many kids the only meal of the day comes from school. This also comes on top of the introduction of uniform washing facilities in certain schools, as such luxuries for some are only in fairy tales, which for the UK appears to have no happy ending in sight. When Boris Johnson won the election in the UK with a huge majority over then Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, the following honeymoon period saw Johnson gain huge popularity across the UK, in part helped by the wave of former Labour supporters who turned to the Tories over the notion of Brexit. But skip forward to today, and the people of Britain who voted for Johnson, namely the working class Northerners, are now being abandoned by the government, who are failing their children, as well as the people, when it comes to job security and the handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. In fact, when one breaks down the failures by Johnson, all of them have an adversely high effect on the poorest populations of the country. As mentioned, there are children going hungry. The handling of the Brexit negotiations, which are likely to see the UK come crashing out of the EU with no deal, and the terrible handling of the pandemic, which has seen the NHS collapse, testing fail, a death rate in excess of 45,000 people, and around 100,000 people per day newly infected. Yet in spite of all this, Boris Johnson's able to find himself in front of the cameras, claiming that he'll not let the British people suffer, or the children go hungry.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. We're going to make sure that we have no children, no kids, no pupils in our country who go hungry this winter, certainly not as a result of any government inattention. We are focusing on that, as we have done very, very hard over the last few months, and we've given, you know, huge sums to local councils to help them out, but also specific sums for helping with meals during what was a very disrupted period.
Yet with Britain clearly becoming the laughing stock of Europe, it seems that the only way to judge the Conservative government of Boris Johnson is through humour, which, as seen in this picture, shows Johnson's front bench openly mocking the situation British children find themselves in. The point, however, that Johnson should be most worried about is, why did it take a Manchester United football player to raise the issue that children are going hungry? Surely this should have been the job of the UK government. And as Marcus Rashford continues to fire on all cylinders, it seems that Boris Johnson is missing the target.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Trump administration has refused to resume work on new federal regulations tabled in 2017 despite the coronavirus pandemic, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article published under the heading Health Workers Sue Trump Labor Secretary OSHA over unconscionable delay of protections against infectious disease. Here's the details of this article. After months of healthcare professionals battling as well as contradicting and dying from COVID-19, A coalition of labor unions on Thursday, October 29th, sued the U.S. Labor Secretary and the Federal Workplace Safety Agency over the unconscionable delay in issuing strong protections from infectious diseases for frontline workers. The lawsuit against Labor Secretary Eugene Scalia and the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, was filed in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and comes amid alarm over Trump administration's inadequate efforts to rein in and provide relief from coronavirus pandemic. The unions behind the case are the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, the Washington State Nurses Association, WSNA, and the United Nurses Association of California Union of Healthcare Professionals, UNACUHCP. The unions collectively represent over 500,000 health professionals in hospitals, clinics, school nurse offices, drug treatment programs, and similar workplaces. In a joint statement, they highlighted Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data showing that more than 190,000 healthcare workers have been infected with COVID-19 and over 750 have died. Some estimates are even higher. A report published in late September by National Nurses United, which isn't part of the new suit, linked over 1,700 healthcare worker deaths to COVID-19, including 213 registered nurses. As of Thursday, October 29th, the virus had infected more than 8.9 million Americans and killed over 228,000. While President Donald Trump and his administration have been widely lambasted for the federal government's pandemic response, the suit also involves actions that preceded the current public health crisis. As NPR reported in May 2020, when President Trump took office in 2017, his team stopped work on new federal regulations that would have forced the healthcare industry to prepare for an airborne infectious disease pandemic such as COVID-19. That decision is documented in federal records reviewed by NPR. David Michaels, who was head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration until January 2017, said, "If that rule had gone into effect, then every hospital, every nursing home would essentially have to have a plan where they made sure they had enough respirators and they were prepared for this sort of the pandemic. There are still no specific federal regulations protecting the healthcare workers from deadly airborne pathogens such as influenza, tuberculosis, or the coronavirus. This fact hit home during the last respiratory pandemic, the H1N1 outbreak in 2009. Thousands of Americans died and dozens of healthcare workers got sick. At least four nurses died. The unions charge that the administration tabling work on an infectious diseases standard and refusing to resume it in the face of the pandemic amount to an unreasonable delay in violation of the Administrative Procedure Act and the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSH Act. Both UNACUHCPAFT President Dennis Duncan and FT President Randy Weingarten noted persistent shortages of personal protective equipment during the pandemic, which are generating fresh concerns given an ongoing surge in cases. Those that provide healthcare to the community should never have to resort to borrowing, hoarding, or rationing PPE to protect workers and patients, said Duncan, a registered nurse. Based on science, standards need to be established for creating, distributing, and storing PPE. oversight is necessary to protect caregivers from expired or poor quality equipment. And healthcare workers need to feel safe in the workplace and know that the healthcare system will protect them and the public alike, she added. Weingarten declared that in times of national crisis, the government's job is to protect people. And in the case of protecting workers on the front line of this pandemic, the federal government has failed. Doctors, nurses, respiratory techs, and other healthcare professionals have been treating COVID-19 patients for the better part of a year without basic workplace protections, including adequate PPE, robust testing, and, most importantly, an infectious diseases standard that would require employers to establish a comprehensive infection control program to protect frontline workers who are facing daily exposure, Weingarten continued. OSHA has failed to regulate employers, which in turn have failed to protect the people caring for COVID-19 patients, Weingarten said. As a result, healthcare workers' infection rates remain troublingly high. This immoral treatment of the healthcare heroes caring through this crisis must end, and both OSHA and employers must be held accountable to make hospitals safe for the people who work there, he added. Healthcare professionals from involved unions, including Ali Whitish, an emergency room nurse at a hospital in Washington State, and Lawrence Rick, a physician assistant at Kaiser Permanente South Bay Medical Center in Los Angeles, shared written declarations supporting the litigation. The unions are being represented by Democracy Forward. The group's legal director, Sean Lev, said that, from the start, the Trump administration abdicated its responsibility to keep healthcare workers and communities they serve safe. The administration's unlawful decision to shelve proposed protections for healthcare professionals has recklessly exposed them to deadly infectious diseases like COVID-19, Lev added. The decision betrays a dangerous disregard for the law and the health and safety of America's frontline workers.
European News Bulletin.
From London, hello everyone. My name is Saeed Puriza. We'll begin this broadcast with the U.S. presidential elections right after this. The U.S. election might just have the highest turnout in a century, and the surge in postal ballots means the results might not be in for weeks. Nearly 100 million people cast their ballots in early voting, and another 50 million are expected to do so today. Bianca Rahimi has more.
President Donald Trump and Democratic vice presidential nominee Joe Biden spent the final hours of their presidential race rallying in key swing states. Biden in Pennsylvania.
Decency, honor, respect. Where has it gone with this president? Well, let me tell you something, folks. Tomorrow's the beginning of a new day. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has left hardworking Americans out in the cold. Tomorrow, we can put an end to a presidency that has divided this nation and fanned the flames of hate.
And Trump in Michigan.
Biden has vowed to increase refugee admissions from terrorist nations by over 700%, including from Syria, Somalia, and Yemen. The Biden plan would overwhelm your communities and turn Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the entire Midwest into a virtual refugee camp.
National polls give a firm lead to Biden, but it is a closer race in states such as these that could decide the outcome. And as in 2016, many people might be brought out to vote who are beyond the pollster's radar screen or off the grid. We've all witnessed Trump's presidential style. So what does Biden plan to do differently? Biden says he wants to restore America's standing on the world stage and cultivate stronger bonds with American allies, criticizing Trump's America First slogan, saying it often leads to America alone. He plans to go back to international accords the Trump administration pulled out of, like the Iran nuclear deal and the Paris Accord on climate change. And the Democrat plans to bring back and build on Obamacare, which taxes those that make the most out of health care. Trump has almost eliminated Obamacare and has cut most taxes on industry. Trump has hinted at post-results wrangling if he doesn't win, and there is talk of him declaring an early victory on election night before all the votes are even in. The atmosphere is tense, and fears of post-election violence are mounting. Guns and ammunition flew off store shelves ahead of the election. Some say they will take matters into their own hands if Donald Trump doesn't win, and minorities are buying guns as well, worried they might be prime targets. Businesses in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., are boarding up in preparation for unrest. Yanka Rahimi, London.
Race and race relations have been a central pillar of American life, but in the lead-up to this election, racial tensions have never been as critical as they are now. As Ahmed Caballo explains in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
I'm asking for the vote of every single African-American citizen in this country. What do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose?
They're calling it the biggest, most significant presidential election in decades. Yet not everyone agrees, and many feel whoever is announced as the winner on November the 3rd, very little will change for the black community in the United States. The African-American human rights icon Malcolm X famously described both the Republican and the Democratic parties as racist, working against the interests of black Americans. He referred to one as the wolf and the other as the fox. No matter what, they will both beat you in the end. He made those comments in 1964, yet they still resonate with many in 2020. Everyone knows Donald Trump has made offensive comments about black people, about Muslims, about Mexicans, and has refused to condemn white supremacist militias in Charlottesville and Wisconsin and elsewhere. Then when challenged on it, he instead endorsed the far-right neo-fascist militia group, the Proud Boys.
What do you want to call them? Give me a name. Give me a
white
name.
Supremacists and
white
supremacists.
Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys.
Militia.
Stand back and stand by.
And this is just since he's entered the political arena. His record goes much further than that. In 1973, Trump's management company, which he was the president of at the time, was sued for operating a practice of turning away black tenants. According to an employee quoted in court documents, the staff at Trump management were directed to tell African-American lease applicants that there were no open apartments. In 1989, Trump placed full-page advertisements in four New York City newspapers, including the New York Times, calling for the state to adopt a death penalty for five black young teenagers who were wrongly accused of raping a white woman. The teenagers were coerced into confessing to a crime they did not commit without their lawyers present in a racially charged case, and their convictions were vacated in 2002. Yet Trump, to this day, has refused to apologize. And despite all the hardship the five went through and all the evidence proving their innocence, in 2019, he still implied that the five were guilty. But the problem is, because of Trump's horrendous record on race relations, his presidential opponent's own questionable record on race seems to have slipped beneath the radar, allowing the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidate to once again take the black vote for granted.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, then you ain't black.
Many argue Joe Biden won the primaries because of the black vote. And if he beats Donald Trump on the 3rd of November, it will be again because of the black vote. as a recent poll shows Biden far outperforming Trump among black voters with 78% support. If you look at his record as a senator, it makes for some disturbing reading. In 1976, he allied with racist segregationists in the South of the United States to keep black students away from the classroom of white students. But perhaps more worryingly than that was his role pushing through the controversial 1994 crime bill, which experts argue laid the groundwork for mass incarceration that has devastated America's black communities. The federal government paid states around $12 billion and incentivized them to incarcerate more people and to build more private prisons.
That 1994 crime bill, it did contribute to mass incarceration in our country.
Crucially, the way the bill was implemented was institutionally racist, leading to black Americans being imprisoned at five times the rate of whites, which devastated African American communities, leading to the current crisis where 1 in 10 black children have a parent behind bars compared to only 1 in 60 white kids. Joe Biden was warned about the effects the crime bill would have on marginalized communities, particularly the African American community at the time. This was his response.
It doesn't matter whether or not they're the victims of society. The end result is they're about to knock my mother on the head with a lead pipe, shoot my sister, beat up my wife, take on my sons. So I don't want to ask, what made them do this? They must be taken off the street.
Furthermore, drugs commonly identified with black users like crack cocaine were sentenced at 100 times the rate of drugs associated with white users like powder cocaine, even though chemically they were almost identical. The explosion of private prisons led to a situation where the United States, despite only having 5% of the world's population, now have 25% of the world's prisoners, with a disproportionately high percentage coming from the African American community. In fact, studies have shown the United States right now incarcerates more African Americans as a percentage than the racist apartheid state in South Africa did. So while everyone can agree Donald Trump is certainly a problem, I hope they can also realize that Joe Biden is not the answer, especially for African Americans who have suffered so much in the so-called land of the free, the United States of America.
Ahmed Caballo with that. Now to other news. Austrian police have arrested 14 people implicated in shootings that killed 4 people and injured another 22 in the capital of Vienna Monday. Authorities have identified the attacker, a 21-year-old dual national from North Macedonia, as a Daesh sympathizer. The interior minister has asked people to stay off the streets. 6 locations were attacked in central Vienna Monday evening, starting outside the city's main synagogue, which was closed at the time. The victims include an elderly man, an elderly woman, a young passerby, and a waitress. Let's cross over to Vienna, where Homa Lesgi is covering that story for us. Homa, I hope you're safe. What else can you tell us?
Yes, well, we had another press conference in the afternoon by the interior ministers. He keeps giving the nation more updates about what's going on. You did refer to the raids that he said were carried out, up to 18 raids, and as you said, there are 14 new arrests. And these are, we're hearing, relatives and close friends of the main attacker who was shot dead by police. This has been called now, in the words of the government, an Islamist terrorist attack. And it is causing fears here in the nation about the issue of migration, refugees, Islamist radicalization, etc. But just to give you all the latest updates, up to now, we know that there is no evidence, the Interior Minister says, that there were any further perpetrators, although they cannot also rule out that this was just an attack by a lone attacker. So that's why they're keeping security levels high, and especially in the first district where this happened, and they're advising people to stay at home and only venture outside if it's completely necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, like you say, it is an ongoing investigation. More details will trickle out, and we'll find out about them through you later on. Let's talk about France and bring that into the conversation. They have seen similar violence in the past few weeks. However, issues of Islamophobia and racism
are well documented there. Are there similar tensions in Austria?
Well, to come back to the issue that we just discussed, and that's how this is going to, you know, affect these relations between Muslims, the huge Muslim population that we have here in Vienna and in Austria, and how it's going to affect the politics here. Well, I think that the first thing we can say is how Chancellor Sebastian Kurz attempted to address this issue, because when he made his statement to the public about this horrendous terrorist act, he said that the enemy, in his words, is extremism and terrorism. The enemy, he said, is not Muslims. He's not trying to pit Christians and Muslims against each other. He's not just saying that the enemy, he made that clear, is a member of any religious community. So I think he was trying to make it clear right now that this is just a case of extremism or terrorism. Mm. And I think this is a sign that he is trying to, you know, not go the way that the French President Emmanuel Macron has been accused of, mm-hmm. you know, of fueling tension. So at least on the face of it, the way that they're addressing this issue is that they are trying to prevent any cases of, you know, Islamophobia or attacks, further attacks, possible mm-hmm. further attacks because of Islamophobia occurring here. We already know, you said, when it comes to Islamophobia here in Austria, maybe it's not as bad as the situation we're seeing in France, but we have seen a rise of, you know, more conservative and right-wing parties here because of this fear that is here in people, mainly inherent, that the refugees, that the migrants that's coming from these Muslim backgrounds are posing a threat to them. This is a rhetoric that's been put forward by the far-right groups who are active here in Austrian politics.
Right. Okay. Tomo Lisky out of Vienna for us. Tomo, thank you. Moving on now. Leaders of France's Muslim community have collectively condemned attacks on French soil done in the name of Islam at a protest against cartoons depicting Prophet Muhammad.
We condemn terrorism and all forms of violence made in the name of our religion, and we express our support to all the victims of terrorism. We are calling for calm, and we encourage our youth to avoid being dragged into this path of violence and destruction.
Thousands of soldiers have been deployed to protect churches and other places of worship as tensions remain high. Emotions boiled over after French President Emmanuel Macron described Islam as a religion in crisis all over the world while defending blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet as free speech. Muslims have since protested and threatened to boycott French goods. To other news, the Director General of the World Health Organization has described the second wave of coronavirus as a decisive moment.
Over the weekend, we saw that while many countries have brought COVID-19 under control, cases in some countries in Europe and North America continue to spike. This is another critical moment for action, another critical moment for leaders to step up.
Europe is bracing for another wave of national lockdowns as cases spike and healthcare systems come under increasing pressure. Infections are rising at a faster rate than the first wave, but with fewer recorded deaths. Nigel Farage, the British politician who helped force the Brexit referendum, has announced a new political faction to fight the UK's second COVID-19 lockdown measures. The leader of the Brexit Party will rebrand his outfit as Reform UK and will challenge the government over its COVID-19 strategy, which has cost billions. The United Kingdom has the highest official COVID death toll in Europe and is grappling with more than 20,000 new coronavirus cases each day, with scientists warning of more than 80,000 dead by the end of winter. Farage, the former commodities trader, has proposed measures for the most vulnerable, while the majority continue as normal to maintain jobs and the economy. In this segment, the U.S. president's plan, reportedly, to declare victory before all the votes are counted. Well, let's get more on that story from Press TV's Richard Sudan. Richard, he says this is not true, but if we were to look at his record, he has denied things in the past that
happen to be to the contrary and the other way around.
Well, I mean, as you rightly said, it should be stated that, of course, Donald Trump has denied the claim, which has surfaced in the form of a report doing the rounds in the U.S., that he will indeed declare victory before the magic number of 290 Electoral College votes has been reached. And I think the first thing we really need to say about this statement, let's suppose it's true for a moment, the very precarious, delicate situation in the US where we've seen over the summer tensions bubble up to boiling point. We've seen chaos on the streets, we've seen protests, people dying and being injured. So the very mention of Donald Trump potentially declaring victory before that is actually the reality. Literally, you know, could be interpreted by the bases mobilized by him in a very serious way indeed. And of course, you know, we've come used to controversial statements and controversial reports emanating from the White House, but this is quite spectacular by any means. And of course, not least because the whole electoral process this year actually quite legitimately could take a long time to really to go through in terms of counting all the votes. Obviously, there's been tens of millions of Americans that have voted by post, obviously because of the COVID-19 restrictions. Of course, there'll be tens of millions about to go to the polls. But of course, you know, if this statement's true, it's going to embolden Trump's base, no doubt about that. And this could well spill over into the streets because, of course, we've become quite used to statements made by Donald Trump being interpreted as a green light. We've not just seen it, of course, with his famous statement to the Proud Boys, or interpreted to the Proud Boys, stand by, stand down. He also, you know, some would say opened up the green light towards journalists during his premiership and his presidential tenure so far. So we'll have to wait and see if indeed this actually happens. But I think, frankly, there'll be a lot of people around the world as well as in America who, frankly, won't be surprised if the president declares a victory before that's happened. And of course, if the president does get wind that the Democrats are doing well and that Joe Biden surges ahead, albeit temporarily, this may well be some kind of tactic that you could see employed. But again, you know, this potentially could make a volatile situation already much worse. We're going to see how this turns out. But in terms of the amount of engagement, the amount of Americans that are now invested in this election, record numbers turning out, the president needs to tread very carefully because any statement he makes could be interpreted in a number of ways, and it could literally spill out onto the streets. We've already seen incredibly chaotic scenes over the summer, of course.
We sure have, Richard. We'll talk about that a little bit right after you bring us the tweets on this story.
Sure, some very interesting reactions online. Let's go first to the neglectful Gardner on the Twitter sphere, who says, "So Trump is barricading the White House, preparing to claim victory early and challenge everything in the courts. He's a bully. Threatening is what he does best. If he loses, he will slink away like a bully as well." Of course, there have been whispers that Donald Trump is going to contest many of the votes potentially, which may come in late. And we also have a reaction here from Shredded Tweet, who says, "It's going to come down to how brazenly corrupt Trump can be, and that's a lot. Expect him to declare victory early, followed by his armed minions turning up to prevent votes being counted in various states, plus him going to court, fireworks, basically." So there's, again, the potential for already an incredibly difficult process to be frustrated further by Trump's statement if he does indeed do this.
Moving on to your second story, Trump saying that there could be violence in the streets following the election. You're looking at the images coming out of the U.S. We're looking at, for example, in Washington, how they're boarding up windows in anticipation of something like that happening. It looks very serious, Richard.
Well, again, it seems like a statement of the obvious to say there's the potential for violence. But again, Donald Trump, with his record of making potentially inflammatory statements, knows very well what he's saying. And of course, you've got the obvious armed groups, the Boogaloo Boys, the Proud Boys. But of course, there's lots of other factions of armed militia just ready to go. And some might say, Saeed, that whether or not Donald Trump wins, his base is mobilized, they're ready to go. And so we'll see how it pans out. But America's essentially on a kind of political tightrope right now. And I think a lot of how this may pan out is really going to depend on the kind of early projections that we see. But of course, there are many millions of votes to be counted, especially through the postal process. And so, you know, the wrong kind of statement here or there before
and
this
and
process
a lot of those
is carried
votes,
out.
Richard, millions of those votes won't be counted until after Election Day, and that is where the problem lies.
Exactly, and of course, if you need a semblance of democracy, many would argue you need a president keeping a cool head, making the right kind of statements. And of course, with the very volatile situation in the US, if these kinds of things are to transpire, you're going to see ordinary people feeling the brunt of this. Of course, I would say that, you know, through the lens of Black America, for example, they have already been dealing with violence on the streets in the form of an increasingly militarized police force. And of course, Donald Trump not only made any statements against that, he's actually conflated, for example, right-wing militia groups and elements with the left-wing in all of its forms. So some would say Donald Trump knows very well what he's doing, and I'm afraid some people will really see this kind of statement of the obvious, the potential for violence, again, as a green light from Donald Trump. And again, you know, we're going to see in the days and weeks how this pans out. But of course, to get the actual result, we're talking potentially weeks. And so, you know, the words from the president, whatever he tweets, is going to have a very real direct impact to what's happening in the United States.
And what has the online reaction been to this, Richard?
Pretty big reaction to this story, as you'd imagine. Let's go first to a tweet from IJ, who simply says, "Shouldn't Donald Trump be doing all he can to stop violence?" And of course, many would say his statements have been the polar opposite to bringing about a calm situation in the US. And we have a tweet here from Anne Connolly, who says, "Trump warns of violence in the streets. Some will undoubtedly take that as an order from their leader, as Trump very well knows." And I can't really say this is the exception to the rule. I've seen so many tweets alluding to this, say, basically saying Trump knows very well what he's doing. And of course, you know, his words could be interpreted in the wrong way very, very easily in what is proving to be the most controversial election in many, many years.
The most controversial election in many years, indeed. Richard Sudan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this broadcast from London, everyone. See you soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight.
The spreading of hate and misinformation primarily starts with key people and organizations, which are sustained by funding from a clutch of foundations and racist lobby groups. They solicit money by telling public falsely that they are in imminent danger from Muslims and boast a history of fabricated evidence that perpetuates conspiracies of radical Islam infiltrating Europe through immigration, civil rights, and advocacy organizations. It's the same manifesto that is once again being laid out in France and elsewhere in Europe. What else did you expect from the so-called religious tolerance and freedom of speech and expression in the West? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, published under the heading, "Hate Speech is Not Freedom of Speech." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Muslims across the globe continue to take part in rallies to protest France's president and his support of secular laws that deem caricatures depicting the Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as protected under freedom of speech. They condemn Emmanuel Macron and members of his government for supporting blasphemous caricatures that are published under freedom of expression. Such depictions are a form of hate speech, and they are